Previously appearing in every port city. And, unlike our efforts, they have the unfair advantage of actually telling the truth, don't they, Jaspar? The Chancellor reflected grimly. Trenaire considered asking the same question aloud, but only briefly. First, because it didn't really matter a great deal either way, after the fact, and second, because nothing he could say would change Clinton's view, and he knew it. Just as he knew that attempting to challenge the Grand Inquisitor's version could actually be hazardous.
At any rate, Clinton went on after a moment, I've sent out instructions to every intendant and to every senior inquisitor. We'll still use the silk glove approach with the laity, for a while at least, but it's time for them to begin making clear to the clergy that the possibility of some sort of patched-up compromise is long past, if it ever existed in the first place. Trust me, they'll soon understand that no defeatism or lack of enthusiasm will be tolerated.
I could wish, Jaspar, Trenaire said after a brief pause, that you'd at least informed me of your intentions before you sent out those instructions. I am Chancellor, you know. The archbishops and bishops should have received a letter of instruction from me, at least simultaneously.
The actions of the Order of Schuler, Mother Church's intendants, and the Office of Inquisition are my responsibility, Zomson, Clinton said coldly. You may send whatever instructions you like to the archbishops and bishops, but it's the Inquisition's task to see to it that all of Mother Church's priests know precisely what is expected of them, and what will be demanded of them, where matters of spiritual and doctrinal purity are concerned.
Trenaire's nostrils flared, but he sat on his own instant surge of anger. What Clinton had just said, in his own thankfully inimitable fashion, was true. Trenaire never doubted that the way Clinton had handled it, like his current half-glare, owed a great deal to the fashion in which the Chancellor had discussed Farade with him, but that didn't make what he'd just said inaccurate. Nor did it change the importance of handling him carefully. Still, there was a point here which had to be made.
I never said it wasn't the Inquisition's responsibility to ensure the reliability and purity of doctrine, Jaspar, he said, in a calm but firm voice. I merely indicated that there are long-standing traditions and procedures by which such messages and instructions are supposed to be distributed. You know that as well as I do, and so do the bishops. If we begin sending out directives which obviously haven't been coordinated with one another, it's only going to engender a sense of confusion and make them wonder if we're truly in control of the situation. I don't think either of us wants that to happen, do we?
He met Clinton's eye levelly, forcing himself not to flinch, despite any inner qualms. It wasn't easy, and he felt rather like an animal trainer facing down a dangerous beast in a cage. But after a moment, Clinton nodded, almost as if against his will.
Point taken, he said shortly. I'll try to at least keep you informed in advance of any additional directives I feel must be distributed in the Inquisition's name.
Thank you.
Trenaire poured fresh wine into his own glass with a hand which, he was pleased to note, didn't tremble at all. He passed the glass under his nose, savoring the bouquet while he gazed out the windows. Spring had come late, hard and cold to Zion, but at least there was no more blowing snow. Not that he was convinced icy rain and mud were that much of an improvement, even when all he had to do was view it from the comfort of his own suite. That suite was every bit as luxurious as Clinton's own, although he'd preferred one with a smaller expanse of windows, and not just because he didn't like looking at snow or rain. He knew the temple's mystic glass permitted the human eye to see through its windows in only one direction, yet something deep inside him always felt somehow exposed when they dined in Clinton's chambers.
Perhaps that's because I know Jaspar makes a habit of mounting his mistresses in front of those windows, he thought sardonically. I wonder what it says about the way his mind works that he wants to be able to look out across the entire city of Zion at a moment like that. I suppose that's just about everything for this evening, then, he said aloud after a moment.
Just about, Clinton agreed. I did just receive a dispatch from Father Adrian in Manchir, however.
You did?
Trinaire looked up sharply.
Yes, but it arrived by courier less than an hour before we were scheduled to dine, and it came in cipher. There wasn't time to get it deciphered before I had to leave. I'll see to it that you get a clean copy tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Trinaire leaned back in his chair, wondering whether or not his clean copy would also be a complete copy.
I'm not happy about what we've heard so far about Caleb's campaign, he admitted after a moment. And I have to confess I was most unpleasantly surprised when we found out he'd managed to launch both his invasion of Khorasan and his expedition against Farad virtually simultaneously.
There I have to agree with you,
Clinton said, and his voice was quite different from the tone in which he'd discussed Farad. In fact, his entire body language was different. He sat straighter in his chair, his eyes narrowed, and he set his wine glass down in front of him, folded his arms on the edge of the table, and leaned slightly towards the Chancellor.
Actually, one of the things that most disturbs me about Caleb's ability to operate with such impunity is that I've come to the conclusion that Elaine's new fleet is going to be about as useful as tits on a boar dragon.
What?
Both of Trinaire's eyebrows arched.
This is the first time you've mentioned that.
It's taken a while for some of the evidence to come together for me, Clinton admitted. I'm not a naval man or a soldier. And, to be blunt, I've had my own responsibilities, and I've been forced to assume Elaine was adequately discharging his responsibilities. Unfortunately, I'm rapidly coming to realize he hasn't been.
That's a very serious allegation, Jaspar.
Oh, fuck allegations, Zobson.
Clinton unfolded his arms long enough to wave one hand dismissively.
I'm not accusing him of playing some sort of games or of shirking his responsibilities. The problem is that his imagination is about the size of a dried pea, a small dried pea, and it's at least partly, maybe even mostly, our fault for not riding herd on him more carefully. You and I both know he's the weak link in our group, after all.
Trinaire was privately surprised by Clinton's frankness. At the same time, he couldn't disagree with anything the Inquisitor had so far said.
He may be the weak link, but we can't really afford to dispense with him, especially now,
the Chancellor pointed out, and Clinton shrugged his broad, beefy shoulders.
Not unless we're prepared to strip him of his office and pick Mother Church a new Captain General, he agreed. And, like you, I don't believe we can afford to risk any appearance of internal dissension. But that's really a bit beside my point where the new fleet is concerned.
Then what is your point?
We're building the wrong ships, Clinton said flatly. I've been reading over reports from my intendants and inquisitors. Obviously, many of them have been deeply concerned about the nature and extent of the Carizians' innovations and their violations of the proscriptions of Zhuo Jing. As part of that concern, they've been reporting on every instance of those innovations' use which has come to their attention. and it's disturbingly clear to me, now that I've had time to think about it, that these new galleons of theirs are far more effective than any galley.
Even the new, bigger galleys?
Than any galley, Clinton repeated in that same flat voice. It's a simple enough proposition, Zamson. A ship which doesn't rely on rowers can be bigger, heavier, and tougher. We can make our galleys bigger and more seaworthy, which we are doing, but at the price of making them slower and requiring more rowers under oars. That's what the Carizians had already done before they started turning to galleons. But a galleon can eventually be made bigger and heavier than anything that's going to be able to move under oar power. And a ship which doesn't have oars all down the side can mount a lot more guns in that same space as well. So, when you combine bigger, heavier ships, which means ships which can carry heavier weights, with a hull design which lets them cram more guns into a broadside, you get a ship which can do what Caleb's ships have been doing to us for the last year and a half. I'm sure the new ships Elaine is building will be more effective than older-style galleys. Unfortunately, I'm coming to suspect that more effective in this case simply means one of Caleb's galleons will need three broadsides to sink them instead of only one.
Sweet Langhorn,
Trenaire murmured, as he reflected on how much Robert Duquerne had already dispersed on the Temple's massive new naval programs. It was, as the Treasurer General had pointed out a few 5 days earlier, the largest single outlay of funds in the history of Mother Church, and the entire enormous first wave of galleys they'd ordered was nearing completion. In fact, scores of them had already been launched in Dolar and the southern ports of Harchong. But if Clinton's biting analysis was accurate, then those ships represented a colossal waste of timber, money, and time. Especially time.
How long ago did you reach this conclusion? He asked after a moment, and Clinton shrugged again.
I actually started suspecting it a few 5 days ago, he admitted. Given how much we've already committed to the building program, and the extent to which Elaine's prestige is tied up in it, I decided to take the time to think about it and be certain of my conclusions before I shared them with anyone.
I can understand that, I suppose.
Trenaire stared out the window again, his eyes distant, and Clinton chuckled sourly.
I wasn't any too happy about it when it first occurred to me, either, he said. As a matter of fact, I still don't find it particularly amusing. The address warned the entire vicarate we were planning to declare holy war, and now it turns out we still don't have a navy we can use to launch a jihad after all. On the other hand, it's a lot better to figure it out now than after we send a galley fleet, another galley fleet, out to be turned into driftwood by Caleb and his galleons.
That's true enough, Trenaire agreed slowly.
Well, after I'd realized that, I also realized the present program hasn't been a complete waste of time. If nothing else, we've assembled the shipbuilding teams, established the yards, and generally streamlined the construction process. Robert's not going to be happy about it, Clinton smiled nastily, and I expect to hear him pissing and moaning about the additional expense. With reason, I suppose, however irritating he can sound. But at least we've got the men and the tools in place if we're going to have to start building galleons instead.
But dare we embrace all of these Carizian innovations?
We'll dare to do anything we have to do to crush these schismatics. As Grand Inquisitor, I can grant special dispensations to anyone, if I need to.
That wasn't really my point, Trenaire said, shaking his head. What I meant is that we've stressed the Carizian willingness to violate the prescriptions. If we're going to accuse them of having done that, and then we turn around and do exactly the same things they're doing...
He let his voice trail off, and Clinton grunted in understanding. But the Inquisitor seemed far less concerned over the possibility than Trenaire was.
We can duplicate their new galleons, and almost certainly this new artillery of theirs as well, without breaching the prescriptions. And the artillery and the new ship designs are only a fragment of all the innovations they've been introducing. The mere fact that we're very cautiously adopting a tiny part of what they've done isn't going to magically make all of their other, far more serious violations disappear. Besides, the entire nature of the contest is shifting. It's about Mother Church's legitimate primacy now, and all the doctrinal implications which hang on that dispute. If we emphasize that firmly and steadily, I don't think we'll have any problems over introducing a few new guns and a few new ships of our own.
I hope you're right, Trenaire said. But whether you're right about that or not, if we're going to have to build yet another completely new navy, it's going to throw a major kink into our plans.
I believe I can safely say that that's a substantial understatement, Clinton said dryly.
And unless we do want to get rid of Elaine and try to find another Captain General we think we can trust, we're going to have to be careful about how we go about changing our building plans, Trenaire continued, his expression thoughtful as his brain got past the shock of Clinton's announcement and began grappling with its implications. If we don't handle this properly, it's going to create a crisis in confidence among the rest of the Vicarate where Elaine is concerned.
Frankly, that might not be the worst thing that could happen, Clinton pointed out. Except, as you say, that finding another Captain General we can trust, especially if we find ourselves being forced to drop Elaine under pressure from other vicars, isn't going to be simple. I'm pissed off with him about this, but I suppose it's only fair to point out, in his defense, that all of us had the same information, and I'm only just now figuring this out myself. Given the fact that Elaine is possibly a third as smart as you or I, I'm being generous here, you'll note. It's probably unfair of me to be too pissed off with him.
I think it might be best to have Elaine reach the same conclusions you have on the basis of reports from Ferraid, Trenaire said after a moment. If we stress that no one else had realized all of this and point out that the Ferraid attack is the first one on which we've really received adequate reports, then perhaps we can convince everyone Elaine recognized the inherent weaknesses of galleys forced to fight galleons as soon as he had an opportunity to review a sufficiently detailed account.
I suppose that could work, Clinton agreed a bit sourly. Although I have to admit that I'm getting a bit tired of admitting things just to head off the damage when someone else starts screaming about them. Still, I think we're in a better position to control the spin on this one, assuming, of course, that no one else finds out about the reports Admiral Thirsk and Admiral Whiteford sent Elaine after Rock Point and Crag Reach.
Trenaire grimaced and wished Clinton could have refrained from that last observation. Still, those reports had scarcely been broadly circulated. It wouldn't be that hard to discreetly disappear them.
This is going to make things even worse where Coruscant is concerned, he said after a moment. I've been assuming that if Hector could only hold out until the spring ice melts up here, we could send a fleet to his support. One capable of at least fighting its way through with additional troops.
I think we can assume that that's not going to happen, Clinton agreed.
Well, that probably pretty much guarantees that Coruscant's going to be lost to us, along with Chisholm and Emerald. which in turn means this Carizian Empire of Caleb's may actually come into existence.
For a while, Clinton said grimly. For a while.
Maybe only for a while, but if Coruscant goes down, especially after Chisholm and Emerald have voluntarily joined Karis, and after Caleb has burned Farade to the ground and hanged 16 Inquisitors, with apparently total impunity, and after we've announced we have to start building yet another new navy from the ground up, it's not going to do very much for morale. And if Hector does the same thing Narmon did, it's going to be even worse.
It won't be good, no, Clinton said much more calmly than Trenaire would have expected. On the other hand, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. Panicking about it ahead of time won't accomplish anything. Besides, you might be surprised.
He smiled unpleasantly.
I've been working on a little insurance plan. One I think will turn Hector into an asset, even if Coruscant voluntarily surrenders to Karis.
Insurance plan? What sort of insurance plan?
Ah, Clinton wagged an index finger chidingly. I told you I'm still working on it. It's not what I'd call really finished yet, and even if it were, everyone likes his little surprises. I think you'll be impressed, but I'm not quite ready to share it yet.
Trenaire frowned at him, but Clinton only chuckled and reached for the wine bottle again. It was considerably later that evening when Clinton strolled into his own suite in a pleasant glow. Of the entire group of four, only Trenaire's wine cellar really matched Clinton's own, and the Grand Inquisitor always enjoyed drinking someone else's wines and whiskies more than he cared for sharing his own. Besides, Trenaire's attempts to inveigle him into sharing his plans for cushioning the impact of Hector's eventual defeat had amused him enormously, especially after the way in which he'd been forced to humiliate himself over Farade. And so he was in an expansive mood as he returned home.
"Good evening, Your Grace," his valet said, bowing to him.
"Evening," Clinton responded.
"I'm sorry, Your Grace, but you have a visitor," the valet continued.
"A visitor? At this hour?"
Clinton frowned, and the valet grimaced.
"I did point out the lateness of the hour, Your Grace, and inquire as to whether or not he could come back at a more convenient time. He informed me, however, that it was important he speak to you. He seemed quite insistent, in fact."
"And who might this visitor be?"
"It's Archbishop Nicholas, Your Grace."
Clinton's eyes narrowed. Nicholas Stanton was the Archbishop of Hanky in the Desnarian Empire, but he was scarcely one of Clinton's intimates. In fact, the Grand Inquisitor had never thought too highly of the man's basic intelligence. Besides, Stanton had been one of those who had favored Samuel Wilson in the contest between Wilson and Clinton for the Grand Inquisitor's office. Only Vickers had been allowed to vote, of course, but the campaigning had been vigorous, and Stanton had done quite a bit of Wilson's legwork. That was one reason he was still a mere archbishop, instead of having been elevated to the vicarate, despite his well-connected birth and seniority.
"Did he say what's so important?"
"I'm afraid not, Your Grace. His Eminence informed me that it was a matter for your ears alone."
"Indeed."
Clinton frowned for a moment, then shrugged.
"I assume he's waiting in the library?"
"Yes, Your Grace."
"Very well. If what he has to say is so important, I suppose I'd best hear him out. And if it's for my ears only, I suppose you'd best leave us to it. If I need you, I'll ring."
"Of course, Your Grace."
The valet vanished with well-trained alacrity, and Clinton continued through to the library. Stanton sat in a chair, gazing out into the snowy night, and Clinton's face smoothed into a mask of non-expression as he saw the Archbishop's tense shoulders and noted the other man's nervously drumming fingers. Stanton twitched around from the window, then stood abruptly as he saw Clinton.
"Your Eminence," Clinton said, stepping fully into the library and extending his ring. "What brings you here at such an hour?"
"I beg your pardon for disturbing you so late in the evening, Your Grace," Stanton said, as he straightened from kissing the proffered ring. "I realize this is highly irregular, but I felt a great need to speak to you, privately."
The Desnarian's voice might have sounded calm to another's ears, but Clinton's were the ears of the Grand Inquisitor. People often tried to sound calm when they spoke to him, especially when what they actually felt was something very different. And this, he decided, was one such time.
"My door is always open to any child of God who feels the need to speak to me, Your Eminence. And if that's true for all children of God, how much more true must it be for my own brothers within the Episcopate? Please, tell me how I can serve you."
"Actually, Your Grace..."
Stanton's voice trailed off, and he looked like a man who abruptly wondered what he could possibly be doing. But Clinton was accustomed to that as well.
"Come now, Your Eminence," he said chidingly. "We both know you wouldn't be here at this late hour unless you'd felt it was essential that we speak. And I fear the office I hold has made me somewhat sensitive to hesitance when I see it. It's too late for you to pretend you didn't feel compelled to come here."
Stanton looked at him, and his face seemed to crumple. Something happened inside him, something Clinton had seen more times than he could count.
"You're right, Your Grace," the Archbishop half-whispered. "I did feel compelled. I'm afraid. Too much is happening. The Grand Vicar's address, what's happened in Farade, the Carisians' defiance. It's all changing the ground under our very feet, and what seemed so clear before isn't clear any more."
"Like what, Nicholas?"
Clinton asked gently, and Stanton inhaled deeply.
"For the last several years, Your Grace, I've been involved with certain others here in the temple. At first, and for a long time, I was certain I was doing the right thing. The others are all men I've known and respected for many, many years, and what they said seemed to make so much sense to me. But now, with this schism changing everything, I'm not sure anymore. I'm afraid that what seemed to make sense is something else entirely."
He stared appealingly into Clinton's eyes, and it took all of the Grand Inquisitor's decades of experience to keep his own eyes gently sympathetic, instead of narrowing them in sudden, intense speculation. He knew the steps to this dance entirely too well. What Stanton wanted was the Inquisition's promise of immunity before he continued with whatever had driven him here. And the fact that an archbishop of his seniority thought he needed immunity suggested that whatever had brought him here was at least potentially of enormous importance.
"Sit back down, Nicholas," Clinton said soothingly. "I know moments like this are always difficult, and I know it can be frightening to admit the possibility that one may have fallen into error. But Mother Church is God's loving servant. Even those who have fallen into error may always be received back into her welcoming arms if they realize their error and turn to her in a true spirit of contrition."
"Thank you, Your Grace."
Stanton's voice was barely audible, and for a moment, Clinton thought the man was actually going to break into tears.
"Thank you."
"Now,"
Clinton continued, settling into a chair of his own as Stanton sat back down,
"why don't you begin from the beginning?"
It was several years ago, Stanton began. Shortly after your own elevation to Grand Inquisitor, I was approached by Archbishop Jason. I didn't know him as well as I knew many others within the episcopate, but I respected and admired him. When he invited me to discuss our shared duties as archbishops of Mother Church, I was both surprised and, I suppose, flattered. In the course of those discussions, however, he began to gently lead the conversation into the direction of church politics, rather than the discussion of pastoral tasks with which we'd begun.
The Desnarian paused, his hands clasped tightly in his lap, then met Clinton's compassionate eyes once more.
Eventually, Your Grace, I learned Archbishop Jason was a member of a larger group, a circle here within the temple, and that circle was concerned about what it saw as church corruption. Its members were unwilling to bring their concerns before the Office of Inquisition, and so they were amassing their own evidence. Exactly what they intended to do with that evidence was not immediately made clear to me, but Archbishop Jason did make it plain that they wished to recruit me as another reformer, and he asked me to begin to take note of any evidences of corruption I might see. At that time,
Clinton's expression never even flickered, and he leaned back, listening. June, Year of God, 893. 1. Elvarth, Earldom of Stormkeep, League of Coruscant.
Are we there yet? Prince Divan asked plaintively.
Compared to his older brother, Philip Osgood reflected, the query was only plaintive. Crown Prince Hector would have asked the question in something uncomfortably more like a whine, and there would have been no doubt that it was a complaint.
Not quite yet, Divan,
Princess Iris said soothingly. She leaned over and tucked the boy's cloak more snugly about him.
Go back to sleep. I'm pretty sure we'll be there by the time you wake up.
Divan looked at her, his eyes puckered with worry in the dim light of the single turned-down lantern hanging from the carriage's roof. Then he nodded, obviously as reassured by her manner as by her words, and settled back down on the comfortably padded seat. It was more than big enough as a bed for a boy of his age, and he closed his eyes obediently. Iris sat looking down at him for several minutes, her eyes tender, but then she drew a deep breath, leaned back in her own seat, and looked across at the Earl of Corus.
I hate this,
she said very quietly, speaking softly to avoid disturbing the boy, who was obviously already drifting back off, despite the rapidly moving carriage's swaying, frequently jouncing motion and the sounds of their cavalry escorts' hooves.
I know you do, Your Highness, the Earl replied just as quietly. I don't blame you. I feel like I'm running away as well.
You shouldn't. She shook her head. I know perfectly well that the only reason you're here is because Father ordered you to be.
Your Highness, it's my honor as well as my duty, he began, but another shake of her head cut him off.
Can we just go ahead and consider all of the obligatory comments already said and accepted? She asked, and smiled wearily at his expression. I'm sorry, Philip. I didn't mean to suggest for a moment that what you were saying was anything but sincere. I've known you too long to think anything else. But I'm so tired of saying what we all have to say, playing the parts we all have to play.
I can understand that, he said after a moment. Still, you are a princess of Coruscant, and I am, by your father's appointment, your legal guardian, and your younger brother's first counselor, if it should come to that. I'm afraid those are parts we can't stop playing, Your Highness.
Given how long we've known one another, and the fact that I'm sure you were there on at least one occasion when my diaper was being changed, do you think you could call me Iris rather than Your Highness, at least when we're alone, Philip? He started to reply quickly, then paused.
I'm not sure that's a good idea, he said finally. Under the circumstances, it's particularly important that your dignity and Diven's are as effectively protected as possible. If I address you too familiarly, it's going to undercut your authority in your person as your father's daughter. And from a more selfish perspective, I wouldn't want anyone to think I'm presuming on the position your father assigned me to for personal advantage.
I don't disagree with any of that. That's why I said at least when we're alone. But it's going to be difficult enough in Delphirac, whatever happens. I'd like to have at least one person I know I can trust who's willing to call me by my name, at least sometimes. And if my legal guardian can't do that, then who can?
Very well, Iris.
His own smile was bittersweet. And you're right, I was present when your diapers were changed.
Good.
A gleam of genuine amusement flitted across her expression. It didn't last long, but he thought he saw a few less shadows in her eyes when it had passed. It was difficult to tell under the present lighting conditions, of course.
I wish he hadn't done it, she said.
Sent you away with Diven?
Sent me away at all, she corrected.
And if there were fewer shadows in her eyes, the lantern light touched the diamond gleam of tears on the ends of her long lashes.
I know he didn't have any choice, not if he was going to send Diven at all. But I ought to be with him, Philip.
Don't think for a moment that this was an easy decision for him, Corus said gently. In fact, I haven't seen any others that were harder.
I know, she shook her head. And I promise I don't want to sound like a petulant, spoiled princess either.
He started to reply to that, then stopped and simply shook his head with a small smile. Iris sat silent for several more minutes, reaching down to smooth her brother's hair across his forehead. Finally, she looked back up at Corus.
I suppose, since there's not any point crying about the basic decision, I ought to spend my moaning time on the travel arrangements instead, she said with a determinedly lighter air.
They do leave a bit to be desired, don't they? Corus acknowledged wryly, as the carriage went over a particularly solid bump. Call it another inconvenience to blame on Caleb and his Carizians.
Oh, believe me, I've got quite a list of inconveniences to discuss with Emperor Caleb some fine day.
Her tone was whimsical, the anger in her eyes was not.
Under the circumstances, I think Admiral Tartarian was entirely correct, though, Corus continued, and she nodded.
At the moment, their carriage, even at its rapid speed, was still some hours from the minor city, little more than a glorified fishing port, if the truth be known, of Elvarth. The journey overland from Manchir had been an exhausting and lengthy ordeal, especially for Diven, who still didn't really understand all that was happening, since Elvarth lay in the Earldom of Stormkeep at the northern tip of the island of Coruscant. But the town had three significant advantages. First, it was so small and insignificant that it hadn't occurred even to Caleb of Carus that it needed to be blockaded. Second, it was about as far away from Manchir as it was possible to get. And third, there'd happened to be a small galleon already anchored there, taking refuge from the Imperial Carizian Navy.
I'm sure the Admiral was right, Iris agreed. And I'm glad he was able to give us Captain Harris.
Corus nodded again. In many ways, he supposed, command of the galleon wing was something of a step downward for Joel Harris. The one-time commander of the galley Lance had been promoted to command one of Tartarian's first armed galleons, the Cutlass. Wing, unlike Cutlass, carried only a handful of falcons and wolves, and she was no more than half Cutlass's size. Of course, there'd been the distinct probability that Cutlass was going to find herself pounded into a bloody wreck by the Imperial Carisian Navy sometime soon. But Harris's appointment to command her had represented an enormous professional step upward. Despite that, he'd responded with every appearance of genuine pride when he'd learned that his prince had chosen him to transport his daughter and younger son to safety. And Corus never doubted that the captain would do everything humanly possible to carry out his mission successfully. Tartarian's plan for doing just that ran back through Corus's mind once more. The notion of sailing east rather than west had a great deal to recommend it, in Corus's opinion. The Carisian Navy was overwhelmingly concentrated in the waters around Coruscant and Zebediah, and its attention was focused on the area between the League of Coruscant and Karis proper. A single small vessel sailing east rather than westward into that area of interest was far more likely to get through unintercepted. There were still risks, of course. The Trelheim pirates came to mind, and so did the swarms of Carisian privateers operating in Doloran waters. On the other hand, Wing wouldn't be flying Coruscantian or Doloran colors. Harris had quite a selection of national colors laid in, along with a splendidly falsified set of Harchongi's papers, and Wing had been chosen almost as much for the cargo she'd carried when the Carisian threat drove her to ground at Elvarth as for her out-of-the-way location. So far, at least, all information available to Corus indicated that the new Carisian Empire was leaving Harchong's limited merchant marine strictly alone. If the reports about Harchong's involvement in building the Group of Four's new navy were accurate, that immunity from Carisian attack was unlikely to last long. For now, though, it appeared to be holding, and they should be able to make Shui Bay without interception. From there, it would undoubtedly be safer to travel overland to Delphirok. "Especially traveling incognito," Corus thought a bit grimly. "You're far too valuable a prize, Iris. Far better for you to be simply my niece, Lady Margly, traveling with me to Delphirok." That, too, had been suggested by Tartarian. It made at least some sense for Hector to have sent his most trusted counselor off to Dolar and Delphirok in search of aid. And if any of Coruscant's enemies decided to interpret his mission as an effort on his own part to get out of Coruscant before the final shipwreck, that was perfectly all right with Corus as well. The additional cover story that his sister-in-law had asked him to take her daughter and son to safety in Delphirok also made sense. Margly Osgood was a few years older than Iris, and Calvin Osgood was a few years younger than Divan, but the match was close enough, and the Osgoods had relatives in Delphirok who might be expected to provide their distant cousins with a safe haven in these troubled times. There were still far too many opportunities for something to go wrong, even if one completely disregarded the possibility of natural disaster overtaking a galleon at sea. Still, under the circumstances, it was probably the best plan available.
"Do you really think this will all work?" Iris asked quietly, as if she'd been reading his mind.
"Honestly?"
He looked at her, then shrugged ever so slightly.
"I do think it will work. I won't pretend there aren't a lot of things which could still go wrong, but I think it's the best plan with the best chance of success anyone could have come up with under the circumstances."
"Then that's just going to have to be good enough, isn't it?" she said simply,
then adjusted her own cloak about her, leaned back in her seat, and closed her eyes. Merlin Athrawes frowned in unhappy agreement with the Earl of Corus's assessment. Although Merlin had been late in picking up on Hector's decision to get his daughter and younger son safely out of Coruscant, he'd realized almost a full 5 days ago what was happening. Unfortunately, Hector's instructions to his daughter's coachman and accompanying cavalry escort had included the order to move as rapidly as possible. By the time Merlin had become aware of what was happening, there'd been insufficient time to get word to the handful of light cruisers covering the waters between Sword Point and East Island before Iris and Divan could reach Elvarth. He'd considered using his recon skimmer to intercept them himself, but only very briefly. The skimmer could have gotten there in time, but what was he supposed to do after he arrived? He could hardly destroy the galleon tied up to the town's wharf without raising at least a few eyebrows. And he wasn't prepared to simply sink the ship with all hands, including a teenaged girl and her younger brother, once the galleon got to sea, either. Nor could he and Caleb send word to the privateers operating in Dolaran waters, not in time for it to do any good, at any rate, without raising all sorts of unpleasant questions about just how they'd come by the information that Princess Iris and Prince Divan were taking a cruise. He'd told Caleb about it, of course, and the Emperor had shared his own unhappy conclusions. If they were lucky, one of their patrolling schooners would happen across wing, snap her up, and discover an incredibly valuable prize. If they were unlucky, which, frankly, given Captain Joel Harris's general level of competence, was much more likely, then Iris and Divan were going to arrive unintercepted at King James's court. Neither he nor Caleb liked the notion of allowing them to slip through their fingers, but it was unlikely that their successful escape to Delphorac was going to have much effect on events here in Coruscant. Not at least in the short term. In the long term, it was likely to prove inconvenient, of course. In fact, it was almost certainly going to prove far worse than that. Which was why Captain Athrawes was spending his time hoping that one of their schooners would get lucky. 2. Duchy of Manchir, League of Coruscant. The surf boat could have been a slightly more solid piece of the moonless night as it came nosing in from the southeast. It had been carefully painted matte black, and the sailors manning the oars rowed steadily but carefully. The last thing anyone needed was for the boat to broach to in the surf and soak its passengers' gunpowder, among other things. Sergeant Edvard Wiston sat on the forward thwart with his rifle standing upright between his knees while he peered at the featureless black blur of the coast. Aside from a pale froth where the gentle surf piled up on the beach of tawny sand, he could make out no details. He thought he could just see the loom of the hills beyond the beach standing up against the starry sky, but he was fairly sure that was his imagination.
"I've spent too long studying the damned maps," he thought wryly. "For the last 5 days I've even been dreaming about them."
Actually, that wasn't such a bad thing. One of the primary tenets of the scout snipers was that it made far more sense to wear themselves out ahead of time, planning and training for an operation, than it did to take casualties a little forethought might have avoided.
"Easy," the petty officer in charge of the surf boat hissed. "Toss oars. Steve, Jacques, over the side."
The boat swooped over the last swells, held bows on to the beach by the sea anchor streamed over her stern, and the indicated seamen swung themselves over the gunwales and into the chest-deep water. They half floated towards the shore, leaning their weight against the boat to guide it. Their feet found purchase as the water grew quickly shallower, and then the bow slid onto the sand with a quiet scrunch. The sound was just audible through the noise of wind and wave, and the petty officer nodded to Wistown.
"This is where you get out, Sergeant,"
he called softly, and Wistown saw the faint flash of white teeth in a broad grin.
"Good hunting!"
Wistown nodded back, then turned to the other members of his double squad.
"All right, lads," he told them. "Let's be going."
He stepped over the side and waded through the wash of water, with the waves surging knee-high as they slid up the shelving beach on the last of their dying strength. Sand swirled away from under his boot soles, carried back out to sea by the receding water, and the flow plucked playfully at his calves. The solid ground seemed to curtsy underfoot as he stepped clear of the surf at last, but he ignored that. And the seawater squelching in his boots, while he looked around, then up at the stars, trying to get his bearings.
"It looks like the swabbies put us in the right spot, for a change," he said,
and several of his men chuckled softly.
"It's blacker nor the inside of a dirty boot," he continued, "but I'm thinking that's our hill yonder."
He pointed, then gave the stars one more look, taking his bearings, and nodded to Eilis Montin, the senior of his two corporals.
"Off you go, Eilis. Try not to fall over your own flat feet."
Montin snorted and started off through the darkness. Wistown and the rest of the scout snipers allowed the corporal to open a suitable lead, then followed him up the beach and into the high, stiff grass that rustled and whispered back to the murmuring sea in the steady wind.
"I hope this brilliant idea of mine is going to live up to its billing,"
Emperor Caleb remarked as he stood on Empress of Karis's sternwalk and gazed up at the same stars Sergeant Wistown had just consulted. No hills were visible from where Caleb stood, but he could see starlight glimmering on the sails of at least a half dozen galleons, and he shook his head.
"I don't think Bryon is particularly happy about closing the land in the middle of the night this way," he added.
"Nonsense," Merlin said from where he stood guarding Caleb even here.
"Why should any admiral be concerned about sailing directly towards a beach he can't even see, with 12 warships and 60 transport galleons loaded with 15 or 20,000 marines?"
"Oh, thank you."
Caleb turned to lean his back against the sternwalk railing and looked at him.
"You do know how to bolster someone's confidence, don't you?"
"One tries," Merlin told him, stroking one of his waxed mustachios.
Caleb chuckled, and Merlin smiled, but his smile faded quickly as he remembered another night on another ship's sternwalk and his final conversation with King Harald.
"Oh, give it a rest," he told himself. "And stop looking for bad omens, too. Caleb's hardly going ashore in the first wave."
"How are they doing?" Caleb asked in a considerably more serious tone, and Merlin shrugged.
"So far, so good."
He considered the schematic Owl was transmitting to him from the Snarks, watching over the small groups of Carizian marines filtering inland.
"Most of them landed within 1,000 yards or so of the right spot," he continued. "We've got one group that managed to get itself put ashore over a mile south of where it's supposed to be, but it's one of the dummies. At the moment, it looks like the rest of them are pretty much on schedule."
"Good."
Caleb turned and stood gazing out into the night once again for several moments. Then he inhaled sharply and shook himself.
"Good," he repeated. "Now, as Dominic recommended to me before Rockpoint, I think it's time I got some sleep."
"I think that's an excellent idea," Merlin agreed.
"Well, there's not anything else useful I can do until dawn," Caleb pointed out.
He sounded much calmer about it all than Merlin knew he actually was, but he also waved one finger in Merlin's direction.
As for you, Sajan Merlin, under the circumstances, I'll grant you a dispensation on your downtime, but only for tonight, mind you.
Merlin snorted and bowed ironically to him.
Yes, Your Imperial Majesty. Whatever you say, Your Imperial Majesty, he said unctuously.
Whiston sighed in relief as Eilis Montan rose silently out of the steep hillside's grass. The sergeant's raised hand stopped the men following along behind him in their tracks, and Montan pointed further up the slope.
"Right where they said she'd be, Sarge,"
the corporal murmured through the steady sigh of the wind.
"Four of 'em. Got them a signal mast and some flags. Looks like a signal fire, too. Two of 'em are asleep. Got one man sitting up on a big old rock. Reckon he's got the duty. Last one's making some tea or something. Lookout's about 50 yards that way."
He pointed upslope and to the right.
"Cooking fire and the signal gear's that way."
He pointed to the left.
"Got their tents and other gear on the back side of the slope." "Good work,"
Whiston replied quietly.
Eilis Montan had even less formal education than Whiston did, but he'd grown up in the Lizard Range Mountains, and his ability to move silently, not to mention his ability to see in apparently total darkness, was phenomenal. He had a woodsman's eye for terrain and a hunter's ability to put himself inside the mind of his quarry, and his own brain was dagger-sharp, despite any lack of schooling. Whiston was working with him on his letters, since literacy was one of the requirements for a scout sniper sergeant. Privately, although he'd been careful not to mention it to Montan, he wouldn't be a bit surprised if the corporal ended up an officer, assuming he ever got a firm grip on reading and writing. Which wasn't a certain thing, unfortunately. Montan was trying harder than he would have cared to admit to anyone, but letters were more elusive than any prong lizard, as far as he was concerned. The sergeant brushed that thought aside, then turned and beckoned for the rest of the double squad to close up on him and Montan.
"Say it again for them,"
he told the corporal, and listened himself, just as carefully the second time as he had the first. When the corporal had finished, Whiston started handing out assignments.
"And you got the lookout,"
he finished 2 minutes later, tapping Montan on the chest.
"Aye,"
the corporal replied laconically, and nodded to the other three men of his section. They were just as taciturn as he was, and almost as quiet. Whiston might have heard a single boot scrape quietly over a rock, but he might not have, too. In either case, he had no worry about what was about to happen to the lookout. He'd given that task to Montan partly because the corporal was the best man for the job in a general sense, but also because Montan had already spotted the Coruscantian. He knew exactly where the lookout was, and Whiston was sure he'd already worked out the best way to approach him. The man making tea, or whatever he was doing, would be illuminated by his cook fire, and his night vision would be non-existent if he'd been sitting there looking into the fire while he worked. The other two were asleep in their tents, which meant none of the three of them were likely to notice anyone creeping up on them. The lookout, on the other hand, was sitting there in the dark with his eyes fully adjusted, and the nature of his duty meant he was at least supposed to be alert. Soldiers being soldiers, and given the fact that not even one of the archangels could have seen anything more than a few hundred yards offshore under the available light conditions, he probably wasn't as alert as he ought to have been. But Edvard Whiston wasn't going to assume that. And if the Coruscantian was paying attention to his duties, sneaking up on him was going to be a significantly more difficult task.
All right,
the noncom said to the men he hadn't sent off with Montin.
Let's go wake these lads up.
Emperor Caleb stepped onto Empress of Karis's quarterdeck and gazed up at the sky. Wispy cloud was moving slowly in from the east, but it was obviously high and thin, not the storm clouds which had been entirely too common for the previous couple of months.